Hey guys, it's Chris here, and I wanted to take a moment once again and thank our newest Patreon member. Huge thank you to Rebecca Shoemaker for your donation. I really appreciate it. Your support means the world, and it helps me keep doing this and helps push me. So really appreciate you doing that. And all that to say, if you guys are a fan of the podcast, Patreon is not only a great place to support the show, but also gain access to all our episodes completely ad-free for just $1 a month. Check out our higher tiers for more exclusive content made special for the Unnerved community. Try it out, and you can cancel at any time. Visit patreon.com/unnervedpodcast. Or click the link in the show notes. Your support goes a long way. Thank you guys so much. Enjoy the episode.
Was he thinking about me that whole time?
Unbeknownst to me at the time, Dave had followed me back there. And as I was opening the door, I felt a solid shove from behind.
From HV Studio, this is Unnerved.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Welcome back to the Unnerved Podcast. It's where normal people share their abnormal stories, and if you enjoy true stories of the strange and terrifying, then you're in the right place. I'm your host, Chris Fricke. If you've ever worked at a restaurant as a server, you know that kindness can go a long way. After all, you are there to serve the customer and make them feel comfortable in that environment. You may even have regulars from time to time, but what if they're not there for the food or drinks? What if you're the only reason they keep returning? In today's story, Jo shares a series of encounters she had with a man that showed an abnormal amount of interest in her. At first, she brushed off the lingering stares, chalking them up to the hazards of the job. But as time moved on, he began acting on his obsession. This is her story.
My name is Jo. This story happened to me in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho during my first and second year of college, and it happened at a bar called The Beacon. It was where I was working. I was a cocktail waitress at the time and occasionally a bartender, but mostly cocktail waitress. I tended to pick up a lot of the daytime shifts in the summer when I wasn't in school, and that also happens to be when Coeur d'Alene gets to be the busiest. We have a huge tourist season that comes in and out of Coeur d'Alene, so very busy with the lake life in the summer and lots of visitors. I, that day, had picked up the daytime shift covering the outside tables at the Beacon, which is about 10 tables. And if anybody has ever waitressed before, you know that's a lot of tables to cover. But it happened to be one of the slower days. And I had a man come in and sit down at a table. A lot of times when somebody came in on their own, I would give them a little bit more of my time, a little bit more conversation, a little bit more attention, just so that they felt involved and, you know, paid attention to. He had a book and a newspaper with him. He was very much ready to sit on his own. He didn't seem to need a lot of my time. So we had some of the basic conversations like, what's your name? So I told him my name and he told me his name was Dave, and we talked about what we did. Well, he talked about what he did, and I told him I was a student. But being smart, I didn't tell him where or what I was studying on purpose. He worked for BNSF, which is a railroad company, and he was an engineer on one of the trains. The one thing that stuck in my head from this first meeting was that he told me his work schedule, which was kind of odd. He worked 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. That was my first encounter with him. Another 2 weeks went by, and Dave came back to the Beacon. He asked to sit in my section, and that's not particularly unusual. And he ordered a gin and tonic, and he sat there, and he was asking a little bit more personal questions, like relationship status. Then I started to get busy with the dinner rush. And so he kind of picked up on that and the fact that I was getting busy, and he closed out and he left for that day. And then he was back the next day, did the same thing, ordered his drink, had some conversation, did it again the day after that, day after that. It went on for the 2 weeks straight that he was in town. So he came back in every day that he was in town off of his shift, ordered one drink and stretched it out, you know, just kind of nursed the drink for hour and a half, 2 hours, and basically tried to make me have conversation with him the whole time. Still not raising a ton of red flags at this point for me. As a cocktail waitress at kind of a popular bar in a touristy town, and you're young, and there's always going to be older male patrons that take a liking to you, and it's just kind of part of the territory. He did kind of start to figure out the bar rhythms. We got slow somewhere between 1 and 2 p.m., and then we got busy again between 4 and 5. That was when everybody started to come in off the lake. And he figured that out pretty quick. And so he would make sure that his timing was somewhere between that 2 and 4 window so that he had as much of my attention as possible. He left for 2 more weeks, went back on a shift. And then he came back, and he started the same cycle, but he stopped ordering anything. He would just order water. And he would sit there and wait for me to come have conversation with him. And it was getting really weird at that point. He did that every day, continuing to ask for my section. The other waitresses began to kind of pick up on my discomfort and his weird tendency. It was probably, honestly, only the last 2 days of that two-week cycle, so like day 13 and 14. And they took his tables and said, oh, she's busy, or oh, she's about to get off, even though it wasn't true. And he picked up on that immediately, really quickly. At this point, towards the end of that last 2 week cycle, is when I truly started to ignore him. Like, I just wouldn't make eye contact. You know, I wasn't going to talk to him, trying to give him the message, if you will. He left on another shift for 2 weeks at that point. And I think the hardest part about this whole thing for me emotionally was that I'd be stressed out for a couple of weeks, and then he would be gone for 2 weeks, and life just kind of went back to normal, and I willfully forgot about him. I was young, and I didn't want to think about bad things, and I just willfully forgot about his existence until he came back. The next time he came back, he had figured out the game, of course, and he did not sit at the tables. The bar was a rectangular racetrack, and it basically went all the way around. And we had three sides that were operational as a bar, and then the short fourth side with the opening into the bar was where there was like the bar back and kind of the dish area, but there were still some stools over there, and that was where he would sit. There was a computer right at the end of the long arm of the bar, and that's where the waitresses all had to enter their food to send to the kitchen. He figured out that I had to stand there. And so he sat in the closest chair that was about 5 feet to the right of the computer. And he would turn his body 90 degrees and face me in the stool and just stare at me. I wouldn't turn my head and I wouldn't look at him and I wouldn't respond to him. When he figured that out, he then moved to the stool that was straight down the bar from the computer. The computer was at about 5 feet high. I'm 5'10", so as I'm standing there, I'm slightly looking down. And when I glance up, I'm making eye contact with whoever's straight down the bar in that stool.
And he somehow, in the craziest fashion possible, figured that out and sat in that chair. And then at some point in this phase, I had a table that was assigned to me that was directly behind that stool that he was sitting in. And I went to go walk past him, go to that table. And as I got past him, he reached out his hand and grabbed the back of my apron and pulled me back towards him, like he was trying to pull me onto his lap. And I whacked him on the arm and I said, "Don't touch me." And then I turned back to my table and ignored him. And I was facing my table and I was like extremely embarrassed, and I know that I had no reason to be. And they saw everything happen and they assured me that I had done nothing wrong. So I took the table's order, and by the time I had turned around, my manager watched him do the apron string thing, and that was kind of the final straw for my manager. And he had a conversation with him while I was taking that order. By the time I turned around, Dave was gone and he had been X'd out of the bar. My manager, you know, organized to make sure that somebody would walk me to my car at night, especially if I was working late. I often ended up getting the parking spaces that were right in front of the beacon, so it made it really easy. Fast forwarding to the following Friday, sometime around like 9 or 10 o'clock on Friday and Saturday, we went from being a slightly kid-friendly family bar to being kind of a meat market trashy bar. So that was the point in time when we had, I don't know if we ever really called them bouncers, but we had door guides that were handling the doors. There was a front door and a back door, and the back door was kind of towards this area where there was a pool table. And the man who worked the back door, he kind of had become a friend of mine while I was working. We chatted all the time when he was working, and he was actually a cop during his normal life and was just doing this on the side for some extra cash. But I think he watched me pretty closely when I was working and stuff and kept an eye on me. My bar manager and I, we did not have a photo of Dave or anything to reference. The door guys didn't know any better. And Dave got in. My manager and I, neither one had noticed. When we got busy, you could hardly walk through the bar. There's a lot of bodies in there, so keeping an eye on every single one that comes in the door is not possible when we're that busy and loud. And he made it in. I don't know how long he was in, probably not very long, because I think I probably would have picked up on him. The bar back had let me know that we needed more tequila. There's a little side area where there's a pool table, and off of that pool table is a short hallway. And in that hallway is a door to the left that goes to the men's restroom and a door to the right that takes you to the storage room of the beacon. But it's actually a door that opens onto a stair landing, and then the stair takes you down into the basement, and that was where extra liquor and such was stored. That door opened with a key and it locked upon closing. So I had gotten the key from the manager and I went to that back hallway to go into the storage room. Unbeknownst to me at the time, Dave had followed me back there. And as I was opening the door, I felt a solid shove from behind. And I sort of stumbled into that stair landing, stumbled in there, and I stumbled down a stair or two and kind of caught myself. And by the time I turned back around and got that door open and the lights on, the door guy that I had mentioned, who was my friend, for whatever reason, his radar pinged when he saw this man follow me back into that hallway. And he had grabbed him by the back of his shirt, like the collar of his shirt, right as he shoved me through that door and pulled him back. And then, of course, not so gently escorted him outside and tossed him out the door. But by the time I had scrambled around and gotten myself back out of that doorway and told the doorman that that was him, he was long gone. I'm assuming that he probably had nefarious reasons. Maybe he just wanted to talk. I highly doubt that he wanted to talk to me in a 200-year-old unfinished basement of a bar, but that really shook me up. I don't know if I was just hopeful or what, but I assumed that that was the end, and I got more hopeful as time went by. And I hadn't seen him or heard from him for a month, probably, at this point. I was getting geared up for, like, fall semester of school and some stuff like that. We were getting towards the end of the summer. I was standing in my mom's kitchen, and I got a text message notification on my phone. I went to open it and look at it, and it was an unknown number, of course, and it was Dave. He said,
"Hi, Joe. It's Dave. Long time no see."
Slapped my hands over my mouth and had a small panic attack. I checked that phone as hard as I could against the fireplace in my mom's breakfast nook. Cracked it in half and broke it. I don't even know if this was the point in time where I could have blocked someone, but my solution at the time was that I needed to change my phone number. I shut down my emails. I had a MySpace at this point that I shut down, and I deleted that. This whole situation, and particularly the text, is actually what finally spurred me to pick my undergrad study course and get transferred into a big university. Fast forward a few years, I hadn't heard from him at all. No text, no in-person contact, nothing. And I finally, towards the end of my degree, so probably 2 or 3 years after all this happened, I finally did open a Facebook. I kept it pretty anonymous, and I had nothing to do with Coeur d'Alene on there. I had nothing to do with the Beacon. I wasn't friends with any of my girls that I worked with at the Beacon, none of that. And I had just moved to Portland after graduating, so this was probably 2012, and I had moved in with my now husband into our first apartment, and I was sitting on the couch, and I got a Facebook friend notification, and he had tried to add me as a friend on Facebook and found me 5 years later. And again, I squeaked and I tossed the laptop. I didn't toss it on the fireplace, I tossed it on a pillow at the end of the couch, but I threw it away from me. Was he thinking about me that whole time? I just randomly pop into his head that day and he said, "I think I'll search for her on Facebook." How obsessive was this person? And that has been the last time, finally, that I have heard and or seen Dave.
When Dave's obsession turned into actions with no set boundaries, Joe was able to escape without being physically harmed. But unfortunately, she couldn't escape the haunting fact that her stalker could someday find her again. And she is not alone. An obsessive stalker is a dark reality that haunts many others just trying to live their daily lives.
Continuing our coverage, around 7.5 million people in the U.S. are stalking victims every year. That number could actually be larger as stalking incidents tend to go unreported.
When it comes to protecting ourselves, safety experts say that we need to really listen to our own intuition.
What's happening with that other person's behavior that's making you feel this way? Why is it inappropriate? Most of the time, we have fear when somebody has violated a social norm.
These are the questions Cheryl Michaels wants you to ask yourself if you think you're dealing with a stalker. She's the director of safety and security at Seattle Pacific University. Michaels says if you find yourself trying to talk yourself out of believing in your gut feeling, consider that a red flag on its own.
The trauma, the fear of what could happen really is a strong motivator to how we respond to it. And often it's to try to ignore it, make it go away. Ignore our feelings, our intuition that is telling us something's wrong here and we need to act.
That act should be reaching out to friends and family, or if it escalates, calling law enforcement. Stalking, by definition, is repeated unwanted attempts at communication, contact, or even harassment.
And the worst thing we can do is ignore our gut feeling that says don't answer that call. And after 30 attempts, we're like, okay, if I just answer this phone call after 30 times, then maybe they'll stop. And all that's done is taught the person who's obsessed that all they have to do is be persistent for 30 times. And then eventually they'll get to make that connection.
Michael says once you make a decision not to engage, you need to stick with it. Consistency is crucial with people who display obsessive behavior. If they continue to pursue contact, keep a record of what they're saying, because that often is what makes the contact a crime.
With stalking and the law that's written for stalking, it has to be something that has more criminal intent involved, like threats to damage your property, threats to harm you or a friend. It can't just be the mere phone call or text message, because then we just have harassment.
According to the National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey, one in every three women and one in every six men have been stalked at some point in their lives.
Even if you don't have an in-person stalker, you could have one online. The internet has made it easier than ever to stalk people, and being careful with what you share on social media can help protect you from unwanted admirers, because you never know who might form an obsession with you. Thanks again for listening to Unnerved. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends and leave a review wherever you get your podcast. If you guys want to see photos related to each episode, including this one, be sure to follow our Instagram at Unnerved Podcast. And for ad-free episodes and bonus content, visit patreon.com/unnervedpodcast. Until next time, take care.